Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon. Carol Bayer Sager has been among the most admired and successful songwriters over the past five decades, responsible for the lyrics of some of the most popular songs of the 20th century, including Nobody Does It Better, Groovy Kind of Love, Don't Cry Out Loud, and the theme from the movie Arthur. In all, she has written over 400 songs. She's won an Oscar, two Golden Globes, and a Grammy for Song of the Year. And she's collaborated with everyone from Ray Charles and Bob Dylan to Frank Sinatra and Barbara Streisand. Now she's written a memoir from Simon & Schuster called They're Playing Our Song, which chronicles her relationship and work with Marvin Hamlisch and Burt Bacharach, to whom she was married for 10 years. I'm very pleased it has brought Carol Bayer Sager to our show now. Hello.
Hi, it's nice to be here. Thank you.
And you've written hit songs for so many famous singers, Michael Jackson, Barbara Streisand, Celine Dion, Whitney Houston, Neil Diamond, Carly Simon, the list goes on and on. Did you write most of them with the performers in mind?
That's interesting. Sometimes yes, and sometimes no. When Marvin Hamlisch and I wrote the song you just played, Nobody Does It Better, we both heard Carly Simon, but after the song was written. And so in that case, no, but immediately yes. And sometimes I wrote with artists who, artists, singers, songwriters, so I knew they would be recording the material first, as in Peter Allen and Melissa Manchester. So when Peter and I wrote a song, I knew it would end up on his album. And sometimes I recorded them on mine. And I think our albums served to be great demos for really great singers who'd mine our albums. One of mine, in case in point, was an album where I put a song called It's the Falling in Love that I wrote with the very talented David Foster. And Quincy Jones heard it and recorded it with Michael Jackson on his first of the trilogy of albums, Off the Wall. I think it was Off the Wall, Thriller, and Bad. It's like that sacred trilogy of Michael albums. But
well, when you hear Michael Jackson sing a song that you wrote with a very different kind of mindset, not thinking of him, do you learn something about your own song?
Yeah, I learned it sounds better.
Because sometimes
it sounds a lot better when Michael sings it.
Playwrights will say, I wrote it, I heard a voice when I wrote that line, and then a great actor took it over, and I heard something totally different.
Yes, you're right, Leonard, that often happens. And
sometimes the songwriters didn't like the version.
The thing that the song I'm thinking of that popped into my mind when you said that is David Foster and I wrote a song for a small animated movie that really just kind of crashed and burned at the box office called Quest for Camelot. And the girl in the animated character was going off on a dangerous adventure, and they wanted a song there. And I said, let's write a prayer for her mother to sing as she goes off. So we wrote a song called The Prayer, and it was recorded by Celine Dion and Andrea Bocelli. And I went into New York with David when he produced the vocals, Andrea's vocals on that record. And when I heard the finished record of Andrea and Celine doing The Prayer, I really thought, this is so much more beautiful and so much more touching than I even dreamed it would be. And I loved the song when we wrote it, but it took on a whole nother level when you have those kind of voices singing this very heartfelt little, what was a small prayer, and got bigger and bigger. But
now you know how Puccini must have felt.
Exactly, exactly.
Now, Carly Simon's Nobody Does It Better wound up the James theme in a James Bond movie. Did you know that was going to happen?
Yes, because Marvin said he was going out to, he had to fly to London to score the Bond's movies, The Spy Who Loved Me. And I said, oh, I'd love to write a Bond song. I have a title if I that just came into my mind. I said, you know, if I was writing that song, I'd call it Nobody Does It Better. And Marvin loved it so much, he raced to the piano and started to play the chorus of Nobody Does It Better. And I immediately wrote the rest of the lyric. So we had this chorus, and he had to, when he flew to London, he had to convince the producer of the film, Cubby Broccoli, that I was a suitable lyricist because I'd never written anything for a film. And so they were reluctant, but they loved that chorus, so they said, yes, let her write it. And I was in Los Angeles at the time, and Marvin was in London, and I just had a tape of the rest of the song, the melody. So I worked in my least favorite way, which was writing the lyric to the melody without him in the room. I love to write with someone else in the room so that I can say, what do you think? And, you know, you throw your inhibitions away and you just say whatever comes into your mind. And it's fine if they say that's awful, because then you get that immediate feedback of collaboration. But I was alone and I had to write it, and I did. And we both heard Carly on it, and Marvin flew to New York and played it for Carly. She loved it, and Richard Perry flew, I think, to New York to get her vocals on it. And then we all flew to London, not Carly, but Richard and I, when Marvin put the strings on. So it was a very, it was quite a worldwide collaboration, but she was the perfect voice to sing that song.
Talk about collaboration. Because in the old days, of course, you would have written a song with Marvin Hamlisch. A song plugger would have taken it to some singer. They would have recorded it live with the backup musicians, and that would have been the end of it.
That's right.
And now the
but
songs
you know
are
what?
Put together like patchwork
but
quilts.
But my life in songwriting never really worked that way. Only the very first hit I had was gotten by a song plugger who played it for a producer who recorded it with an English group called the Mindbenders, and my first hit was called A Groovy Kind of Love.
How old were you when you wrote
that? I was about 20. Mm-hmm. And it went to number one, and I thought, oh, this is so easy. But the fact is, all the songs that came after, I pretty much either got by calling someone or playing it, finding the producer myself, or as I started to have more and more hits, I was able to call the artist directly.
Did you grow up listening to this kind of
I did.
Stuff? You were,
I did. I loved.
You grew up near the Brill Building, you say, so you actually had maybe proximity was a factor.
Well, it certainly helped. I mean, I think if I was writing in Des Moines, Iowa, at the same time, I wouldn't have had the access that I did, being 10 blocks away from the Brill Building and Tin Pan Alley and 1650 Broadway. And at that time, I was 15 years old, so it was so unique at the time to have, I was writing with a girlfriend in high school, to be roaming the halls of the Brill Building, knocking on doors, that you made relationships. So even if you didn't get your song recorded, you knew you had a place to go back and play the next song.
What happened? You were teaching, just starting to teach when the song
hit?
Well,
I was already writing songs, but my mother and father were very practical, and they said, how many people do you know who are hit songwriters? And I said, none. And they said, that's why we really think it's important that you teach. So I was teaching school in a vocational girls' school in New York City called Mabel Dean Bacon. And I would go down and call the charts at lunch hour, see if the song was, how it was doing. And Groovy Kind of Love became a hit while I was still teaching school. And it was amazing. I also saw an incredible inequity at the time, because I was teaching school for $5,200 a year, and I got a check in the mail for something like $34,000. And I went, oh my God, for something that I just love to do, and it took me no time, and here I'm punching a clock every day. And I really saw that in that moment, the inequity of what, you know, teaching is so important, educating our children, and what I did as I would have done for free, you know, to write that song.
But you got 7 years' pay with one check.
I know.
That lead you to quit teaching?
It did, because I could now support myself full time and just devote all my time to writing.
My guest is Carol Bayer Sager. She's written a memoir called They're Playing Our Song. It is published by Simon & Schuster. You write that as a child you had the intense need to be seen and heard.
Well, I think I begin my book saying that if my mother had been a little less critical or a little more nurturing, maybe I wouldn't have had the intense desire to be seen and heard. But I believe that it is just that. That when I was very young, I had a ventriloquist act, and my dummy could say things for me that I couldn't say for myself. And that very easily seemed to, you know, move into lyrics where I could say things. I wasn't the artist, so I didn't have to take responsibility, but I could write in song some of my feelings.
And it's always been in collaboration. You've never written a melody?
I did once, and then I realized I had stolen a Paul Simon melody, so I went back to collaborating. But
well, at least steal from the good ones.
Always steal from the best, that's right. But I can write music, and I often, some of my favorite collaborations is where there's just no boundary. I can say, what about this, and play something, and they'll love it. And they'll say, well, why don't you say this? And that's my favorite way to write.
So it's not the old question, who writes the lyric? What comes first, the lyrics or the melody?
No.
Simultaneously?
That's my favorite way to write. Simultaneously, give and take. I wrote that way with Peter Allen and Melissa Manchester and Marvin. And the only person I didn't write that way with was Burt Bacharach, who, maybe that's why he's one of the great, great songwriters of our time, because his melody, once he came up with it, was locked, and you had to fit your lyric to that melody.
Well, yeah, those quirky rhythms. It must have been
fantastic,
both fun and difficult.
Challenging, and I don't know how much fun. It was challenging because his rhythms were so unique, and you had to fit your words in and make them feel effortless. The best story I can tell you is when Bert and I were writing their That's What Friends Are For, and he played me the melody, and I said, oh, I love that. He played da 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 da, and I said, great, why don't we say I never thought I'd feel this way. And he said, because that's not what I played. I played da-da, da-da-da-da, da-da-da. So I said, great. I never thought I'd feel this way. Carol, I'm playing da-da. I need that 16th note. So I said, fine, then just say and. So he goes, and I never thought I... And when I hear it still to this day on the radio, I go, gosh, Bert was right. And not only was he right that it sounds better to start with, and I never thought, he was right even in my rebelliousness of saying, just say and. It makes the lyric so much better because you're coming in the middle of a thought. So I give you that, Bert. You were completely right.
You are critical of him in other ways. We'll get to that after we take a little break. But your follow-up hit to A Groovy Kind of Love was Midnight Blue, written in partnership with a then little-known singer named Melissa Manchester.
Yes.
We're going to go to a break. Maybe we'll talk a bit about that. And,
sure.
And your collaboration with Marvin Hamlisch and with Burt Bacharach, with
sure.
whom you were married 10 years.
Yes.
Whatever it is, it'll keep till the morning. Haven't we both got better things to do? Midnight blue. Even the simple things become rough. Haven't we had enough?
That's the theme from the movie Arthur, for which Carol Bayer Sager won an Oscar.
Actually, Leonard, it's not.
No.
I won an Oscar for Arthur's theme.
Oh.
And
oh,
this is the theme from
Night
Shift.
Oh, you won a Grammy for this one.
Yes,
I'm sorry.
I won Song of the Year with Bert.
Uh-huh. But this one, how many people did you collaborate on this one?
Just Bert and I wrote this, but the story behind this song is that we wrote it for a movie called Night Shift, which is a small cult movie. It was Michael Keaton's first movie. And Rod Stewart recorded it, and it wasn't a hit. They didn't release it as a single. And when Bert and Dion got reunited, he played her the song, and she loved it, and she said she wanted to sing it with Stevie Wonder. So she put her voice on, and then the night Stevie was coming to the studio, I told my girlfriend, Elizabeth Taylor, who, yes, it's that Elizabeth Taylor, and she was my girlfriend, that Stevie was going to put his voice on the record. And she said, oh, I've always wanted to meet him. So I said, come down to the studio with us. So Elizabeth came to the studio with me, albeit a little late, but because she always did everything a little late. And when Elizabeth was listening to Stevie sing, I looked at her, and it just occurred to me that this would be a wonderful song to give the proceeds to AMFAR, the American Foundation for AIDS Research, because Elizabeth was the first huge celebrity who came out and was brave enough to shine a light on AIDS and embrace its victims and you know, speak up and for them. And she was the co-founder at the time of AMFAR. So then Stevie finished his part, Gladys Knight and Elton John, and we raised a number of millions of dollars for AIDS research.
And Elizabeth Taylor introduced you to Michael Jackson. Is that true?
No, oh. That's not true. No,
oh, gee,
but say anything you want.
Okay.
No, I actually introduced Elizabeth to Michael Jackson,
oh, well, okay.
And she became
almost as good. They became
very good friends with him.
Well, let's jump back a little bit. In the 70s, you were introduced to Marvin Hamlisch. I got that one right?
Yes, you got it perfectly right.
And you write that you are an improbable pair.
Well, we were from day one. I mean, he liked to dress in a suit and a tie. And as you can see, I'm still wearing my jeans and maybe a little more grown up, a nice jacket. But, you know, he was very New York, very buttoned down, very much concentrating on Broadway. He'd had an enormous success with A Chorus Line and won a Pulitzer Prize. And I was this pop songwriter from L.A. at that point, not fully, but living more in L.A., coming back and forth. And when our relationship kind of moved from friendship to a romantic relationship, we lived together in L.A., and he was always envious of the pop songs I was writing. And I would say, but you're Marvin Hamlisch. You won 3 Oscars in one night. You wrote A Chorus Line. So he saw himself as this kind of stately older man. We were actually the same age. And he saw me as this young pop, you know, I don't know what he thought, but it was a strange relationship because together we were like jumping beans. I mean, his energy plus my energy, both New York energy, even in L.A., you know, we were just talking over each other and writing so quickly. And
is it good to be romantically involved with somebody you're collaborating on music with? On
songs looking with? Back between Marvin and then a 10-year marriage to Bert, I would say no.
Even though a lot of great songs came out.
Well, I'm grateful for the great songs. I'm even more grateful for Bob Burt's and my son, Christopher Bachrach. But it's an enormous amount of time spent with one person. You spend the time writing, then you go to the studio and make the demo, then you write some more, then you produce, then you're supposed to go into the house and be this happily married couple. But Bert was obsessive with his music, and we'd be at home at 8 o'clock at night. I'm ready to watch my favorite television show, and he'd say, "Hey," and he spoke in the rhythms in which he wrote, "Hey, Kat, you wanna come over to the music room with me? I just wanna have this thing in my head. I wanna just play it for you." Now, Bert, at 8 o'clock, I mean, we are done. We worked all day, you know. So it was a lot. It was a lot.
And you're right. The only thing Bert was able to commit to was Bert. So that was another kind of a problem?
Well, you know, Bert told me, you know, Maya Angelou said, when someone shows you who they are, believe them. Bert told me and showed me who he was very early on. But I went into illusion because I thought I was very much in love with him. And it's not that Bert ever meant to hurt anyone, I don't believe, in his life. It's just that Bert's music came first. That really was his number one thing in his life. Then came his family, his wife, his children, his horses were in there, his working out was in there, he had an awful lot of things he needed to do, so that by the time he got to you, there wasn't all that much Bert to go around. And he said to me once, "Hey, babe, I'm a selfish guy," you know, and maybe that kind of genius comes with that kind of persona. Look, we're great friends today. He's been a wonderful father to Christopher, our son. I visited him just last week because he wasn't feeling too well. And, you know, once I healed, and actually he did me the greatest favor of my life, because I then finally found there was a man who came into my life who was a real adult, and his name was Bob Daly. We're still married. It's 25 years later, and you know, what he said he meant, and what he did, he, you know, he was an executive, something that I would have run from in the past, and he finally made me feel safe, which is something I never felt in my life, not in my childhood and not in my early years as even songwriting.
A science writer once told me that the third major relationship is always the best, because the first time you blame the other person, the second time you realize that you played as much of a role in the problems as
I do
as
realize
the spouse
that.
Did.
That's true. I realize with Bert I was responsible for a lot of what went on.
Let's talk about the title of your book, The Playing Our Song. It's also the name of a play based
on... A musical. Well, Neil Simon looked at Marvin's and my relationship. They were working together on trying to make The Gingerbread Lady into a musical. And Marvin would come in and say, oh, I'm living with this girl. She's so crazy. She this, she that. And Neil got more interested in the relationship between this neurotic Jewish male Marvin Hamlisch and this crazy young kind of wacky girl that he was living with. And he asked Marvin, could he take me to lunch? And we went to lunch and he said, you know, I'm thinking about ditching Gingerbread Lady and writing a musical about the two of you. How would you feel about that? And I said, great. And actually, Marvin and I were about to split up then, but we were friends when we met and we went back to a friendship and had a great time writing the show.
It's kind of odd that you have good friendships with all the people you've split up with.
Well, you know, I have a girlfriend who said something wonderful to me once, and I've lived with it and believe it. Relationships never have to change if you never have to end if you allow the form to change.
I'm speaking to Carol Bayer-Sager, who's written a memoir called They're Playing Our Song. How did you meet Peter Allen?
We were fixed up by a publisher at Metro Media at the time, and I instantly loved him, and I think we connected immediately.
Did it help the fact that he was just a friend and a collaborator?
Well, he was gay,
yeah,
which made it completely a friend, and I think... Yes, I think it helped in so many ways, his whole sense of... But he was one of a kind, Peter. He left us way too soon. His sensibility was fantastic. He lived every moment of his life with a champagne glass in one hand and, you know, a song in the other. It's great.
Now, you've also recorded.
I have.
Going all the way back to 1977.
Yes.
Now... Some of the other songwriters in similar situations, like Carole King, became famous as singers as well. Has it been okay for you to have a respectable career as a performer, but really be best known
as a
lyricist?
Yeah. I mean, I actually never thought I was much of a singer. I'm still not. I just think that it's always interesting when you hear the songwriters sing the songs they wrote.
Well, you did the demos.
Sometimes. But I think I would never dream of singing a song I didn't write. I mean, I'm not a singer classically. Mm-hmm. I just interpret my own songs.
Bob Dylan, someone who rarely collaborates with other songwriters, reach out to you to co-write a song?
That was amazing.
Are you going to get a piece of the Nobel Prize?
I don't think I'm even going to get a scintilla of the Nobel Prize, which he richly deserves. But it's a very funny chapter in my book, if one of you out there wants to read it. It was the worst collaboration, but brilliantly funny and enjoyable, because I kept looking across and saying, I'm writing with Bob Dylan. You know?
Now, it didn't become a hit, but no, why was it a complicated collaboration?
Well, because as you might imagine, he is the most self-contained artist. And he's not a collaborative person by nature. So it felt like, I don't know, back in grade school, if you wanted to copy off of a friend's test and they covered their paper because they really weren't your friend and didn't... I mean, that was what it was like writing with Bob. I mean, we sat across from each other on two beds on either side of a big barn. So already there was like so much space between us. It was like unnatural to me. And I would give him lines and he'd say, yeah. And then he'd sing it back and he wouldn't have the line I gave him. He'd change it to something else. And so I don't know how many of my lines ended up on the floor. Maybe only about 10 of them ended up in the whole song. And I felt weird about it. I said, Bob, I don't think I can take half credit for this song. You threw out half of what I wrote. And he said, well, I wouldn't have written it if you weren't here. Mm-hmm. You know, I said, yeah, but he said, okay, I'll take two-thirds, you take a third. I said, okay, that sounds fair. But, you know, it was such an unlikely collaboration. We wrote a song called Under Your Spell, which is pretty good. I mean, pretty good. He wrote most of it. I loved the last line. I write in the book, I loved the last line. I hope that I don't die of thirst reaching for the well. And I said, I love that last line. I wish I wrote it.
It must have been odd writing a song with somebody who's famous for his lyrics. But is that the only time that ever happened with you?
With another really great lyricist?
Let
me not call myself great, but with a great lyricist.
Carol.
I've collaborated with Carole King, who sometimes writes her own lyrics, and Carly Simon, who sometimes writes her own lyrics. But they both have been known to write with other people who write lyrics. So no one as completely singular as Mr. Dylan.
Hmm. Are there younger artists that you'd like to work with?
Well, I just wrote a song that's actually number 12 this week, 8 this week on the dance charts, for a young artist named Jessica Sanchez, and it's called Stronger Together, and it happens to be the campaign song for Hillary Clinton and the DNC, and they played it all through the convention, and we'll see. I liked writing again.
There was a John Oliver bit where he had a whole bunch of singers, singer-songwriters, sing a song called Stop Using Our Song because politicians use songs without permission.
I don't know who your audience is, but I know every songwriter I know where Donald Trump has used their song, they've threatened to sue because they haven't given permission for that song to be used. And I actually not only gave permission, I wrote it for her with Babyface, a great talent, Kenny Babyface Edmonds, and Bruce Roberts, who's very active in the Democratic election this year. And, you know.
Well, it sounds to me like you've written a lot of songs knowing that they were going to serve a purpose, whether
That's
they were
in
a movie or, in this case, a political campaign.
That would be my preference, if I always knew where my little song was headed, you know. You don't always know, and I think I started to write less and less when more and more songs were, you know, making it into my trunk under my piano bench and not making it onto the charts.
Well, that's because movies aren't what they used to be.
Well, movies.
Do you write any songs about car crashes?
Yeah, big explosions. Blow it up.
You began painting not that long ago.
I did. I began painting for the last 6 years until I started writing the book, and I had 3 art shows, and turned out that I could paint sort of a little good. And, you know, I'll be interested in what I choose to do when I finish promoting They're Playing Our Song, the book, not the show, whether I'll want to write songs again or paint or write another book. I liked the process of writing a book. It was a lot about rewriting, more than I ever dreamed, but I liked the process. I thought of it as a very long song without music.
Do you think that the fact that you've written so many songs makes it easier just to sit down and start writing? Because the biggest problem for a beginning writer is just keeping that thing going.
Well, I had the discipline to write all the time, but I thought the book was written after about 6.5 months. I gave it to my agent, Binky Urban, and she said, well, there's a couple of great chapters here, but beyond that, you don't have a book, Carol. I said, I don't? She said, no, you have to go back. You have to dig much deeper. You have to get into those really, those places, and you have to put context in, and we need to know this and this. And eventually, like a year and a half later, she said, now you have a book. And she gave it to one publisher to read over the weekend. She didn't put it out to a lot of people. That was Jonathan Karp at Simon & Schuster. And he had seen their Playing Our Song, the musical, when he was a young man, very young, and fell in love with it. And when he read my book, he not only loved it, but I got doubly blessed because he said he wanted to be my editor. So my book is edited by the publisher of Simon & Schuster, and
wow.
he's an extraordinary man. So I feel very blessed. I hope people will read it. It's the thing that one of the reasons I wrote it was not so much to write about all these songs, though they have been my life, but because I lived my life for so many years in fear and with so much anxiety, and I wanted people to understand that they should never compare their insides to someone else's outsides, because nobody knows when they look at you. They only see the facade that you want them to see, but they have no idea of the fear or terror or you know, just complete. I wasn't even present in so much of my own life, not until much later, not until I met Bob in my 40s, did I really was able to live in my own skin. And that's because he made me feel safe.
Carol Bayer-Sager will be speaking and signing books this Wednesday at 6:30 at the Long Island Lit Fest at the Madison Theater in Molly College. For tickets and directions, you can find a link on our show page at wmyc.org/lopate. Then on Thursday, she'll be at Shakespeare and Company at 7 o'clock. That's at Lexington Avenue between 68th and 69th Streets. We're going to go out with Arthur's theme.
Good.
Best That You Can Do, sung by Christopher Cross. The book from Simon & Schuster is They're Playing Our Song. Thank you so much, Carol Bayer-Sager, for being on our show.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Once in your life, you find her. Someone who turns your heart around. And next thing you know, you're closing down the town. Wake up and it's still with you. Even though you left your way across town. Wondering to yourself, hey, what have I found?
Listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
If Mark Antony wanted Romans to lend him their ears, nowadays he'd probably tweet, although he'd need a catchy meme. Google would sell data analysis of his tweets to the NSA and Amazon could place ads to nudge more followers. Attention is big business. Tim Wu, a law professor at Columbia and author of The Master Switch, discusses the market for our attention for us in his latest book, The Attention Merchants, The Epic Scramble to Get Inside Our Heads. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it's brought Tim Wu back to our show. Welcome back.
It's great to be here again.
Now, who are the attention merchants?
So, you know, they used to be a pretty confined group of businesses. And originally, just the old line media, newspapers, or television stations. But over the last years, the business models expanded nearly everywhere, so that the companies interested in gathering up your attention and reselling it cover a whole range of activities. Most of the internet companies, you know, it's almost everywhere. And the basic thing they have in common is they want you as a consumer really to be their product so they can resell you to someone else. And that's the model.
Are there non-commercial attention merchants?
You know, not really the way I see it. I mean, you might think of politicians that way. They mm-hmm. gather up huge crowds to have power. Actually, in the history of the 20th century, you can think of propaganda states as attention mm-hmm. merchants in a way. But they're not commercial. Their interest was, for example, gathering up a huge army to go march on another country. British and American propaganda, World War One being the pioneer. So if they're non-commercial, it's for political power.
Hasn't this election ended up being about attention? One of the complaints from Sanders supporters was that the media ignored him.
I mean, absolutely. I think that this election was the final merger of entertainment and politics. You know, people have been talking about it for a long time, but you know, the prospect of someone with no experience at all using incredible powers of attention harvesting, like a master of creating a plot that every week there's a new scandal or something else happens, you know, has amounted to billions of dollars of free coverage for Donald Trump's presidency. And presidential campaign. And so elections have long been attentional contests, but what has happened is the techniques of entertainment and the entertainment industry have certainly moved fully into the political realm, and that's what we're seeing.
Has human attention been turned into a commodity, something that can be bought or sold?
I mean, I'd say absolutely. You know, the industries have become so much more sophisticated in targeting your attention at the exact right moment. So one of the reasons that Google has been so successful is that they offer you not just, you know, like a radio listener, well, that's an attractive audience as well, but they offer you right at the moment you're making a decision. You're looking for something. So I want to buy, let's say, a new seat for my nursery or something. And they know that. And so it's not only just your attention that's being resold, but it is your mind at a specific decisional state. And so I think it's become much more specific.
How related are trade in attention and control of attention? If you can control attention, can you set the agenda?
Well, that's the first step. So in our times, the prerequisite to anything, getting started, political campaign, a new product, you know, a new movement, you were talking about Bernie Sanders, is you have to somehow get attention or nothing happens at all. I mean, Bernie Sanders' campaign is a great example. He just was running hard. He had a lot of ideas that people were interested in, could not get attention for the first several months. And so it was as if he lost the battle before the battle. So before you have any control over attention, you can't start trading your product. No one buys something they've never heard of, you know. Even if you lower your price, let's say you have the latest and greatest new sunglasses and they're half the price. Well, if no one knows they exist, the market can't function. So that's how they're related.
Haven't producers of one kind or another been competing for attention or marketplaces for thousands of years? Is the difference that the mediums or the media, as we should say, have changed?
So here's what I think has changed. So obviously there's been people selling things and wanting you to buy their products for thousands of years, you know, since the invention of currency or something.
Or humans have been presenting themselves
right,
as something
right,
to be
right.
selected.
Yeah, but what's new, in fact, what was founded in this city in the New York Penny Press, 1830s, I'm going to point to the New York Sun as a starting point of this, was the idea that you sell something very cheap, like a newspaper, and you gather up a big crowd, and then that audience is then your product. You see, it's a very different, it's an unusual business model. And that's different than the usual business model of just selling something. So a book publisher, you know, you pay $10 or $20, $30, and you buy a book, and that's the end of the transaction. A different model where you would give the book away for free, everyone reads it, and then you resell the people reading it to another person. So it's a much different business model. And what's strange is just how many parts of our life it's taken over. You know, all of the web, you know, mobile phones, anywhere you get something for free and you wonder, why is this free? It's probably because you are being resold. So I think that's important for listeners to understand.
But we're getting out of this trade, we're getting the free part?
The consumers get the free part.
Because there's a popular line, if you're not paying, you are the product.
Right, and I think that is exactly right. When you are not paying, when you're getting a free newspaper or free internet services, if you're not paying in some way or another, you are being resold. Access to your mind is the commodity. Yeah,
that's the hidden price we're paying.
Yeah, that is the hidden price. And I think it has its cost when you really look carefully at it. What happens is the media that are completely advertising dependent need to have you in a receptive mood and constantly ready for advertising. And that constrains what kind of messages work well. On the internet, for example, you know, the internet 15 years ago was a lot of blogs and sort of maybe more thoughtful, if amateur, writing. These days, it is all about clickbait. You know, it's all about what can I get someone to click on. And so the whole medium has warped itself, transformed itself, become a low attention, click forever, casino effect kind of medium because it is driven by ad revenue.
I'm speaking with Tim Wu, whose latest book is The Attention Merchants, The Epic Scramble to Get Inside Our Heads. Are the issues you discuss arising around the world, even in different kinds of economies like China's?
You know, I think we lead the world in this business model. And
should we be proud of that?
it's a good question. I mean, this is a particularly American phenomenon and one in which we invented it. And with the success of our most powerful internet companies overseas, we are exporting it, you know, to support a global audience and global reselling of audience. So I think to the extent it's appearing overseas, it's pioneered by Americans.
Are media companies and advertisers nudging us in the sense that's been described by Cass Sunstein, Daniel Kahneman, and others?
One of the things that I think is going to happen over the next decade is that because many people have become much more resistant to advertising. They try to skip it or avoid it or block it. There is a move towards what Professor Mayer Einstein calls black ops advertising, or there's this move towards making the manipulation much more subtle. So if you might imagine, you know, let's say you have a self-driving car in the future. Well, how does it decide which route to take? You know, how does it decide which gas stations to go to? There's a big market because we have become, as I said, resistant to advertising. There is a strong market for nudging us subtly, almost surreptitiously steering our preferences. I'm concerned, for example, about the rise of, the Internet of Things, which could be great, but could also end up where we have a refrigerator or a washing machine, which is trying to sell us, you know, this kind of detergent, or, you know, says, well, I really want Tide, I don't want that cheaper brand, or something like that. And these are trends that concern me.
Well, we tend to think that we can just get rid of the advertising on the Internet. In fact, the Internet advertising was considered less effective initially because you just zip right past it, whereas in a newspaper, you're confronted with that right-hand page.
I think that has changed. I mean, if you've use the internet lately, it's really tough to get around it. You know, think about YouTube, for example. It's come to the point where you almost have to watch as much advertising as video to watch it. It's got, you know, that was 15 years or 10 years ago. It's become so hard to avoid. On the other hand, there are technologies for avoiding it, which are being employed in something of a revolt. But I think the ad load, as the jargon is, the amount of advertising on the internet has become close to unbearable for many people.
And then the New York Times and others now offer what are called native ads, ads that blend in with content, looking like news. This is the opposite of the old idea that you called attention to yourself through a special typeface, distinguishing yourself from what the rest of the print looked like. Now you want it to look like a news story?
It is part of the trend of trying to make advertising more surreptitious, more subtle. It's not a trend I'm fond of. If you look at the long history of advertising and advertising-supported media, it has always posed ethical questions. You know, from the early days of the penny press in this city, where they, to attract larger audiences, would run, and this is something you can learn more about, they would run stories that were false but exciting, like the discovery of life on the moon, just to gather a large audience. My point is that there's always a temptation when you have advertisers to run at the ethical limits. And one of those limits is running articles that look like real articles but are advertising. Actually, you know, you say people wanted to mark themselves off. 100 years ago, there was more interest in just running advertisements, what were really advertisements but look completely like news stories. So, for example, Discovered. I read this when I was researching the book. An 1880 story, Discovered the Cure for Death. You know, the elixir of immortality has been discovered. Dr. So-and-so. It looked completely like a normal news article. And at the end of it, for details on how you can get the elixir of immortality, please write this address. Mm. So it's an advertisement, but it looks like a news story. So people read it and they say, well, they've discovered the cure for death. I think I better buy that. So
I wonder how many suckers bought that.
A lot. Patent medicine, one of the great inventors of advertising, forces behind it, was a multi-billion dollar, one of the biggest industries late 19th century. And it was mainly because of their advertising, because people thought that was the real deal.
Shouldn't economists for ad agencies and companies buying ads take note that there's demand for ad blockers and other tools to get around advertising?
Well, I think they are taking account of that fact. And what I hope, here's my optimistic take, is, you know, having looked at the long history of this in my writing, there are periodic revolts by consumers against advertising. And one of the in situations we have, particularly on the web, is we have a very unstable situation where the ads are so intrusive and so privacy-defeating that people are starting to revolt. And I think that revolt will push things back to a more sustainable level. But I do think we need, I do think they need to take into account, and that's partially why they're moving to these more surreptitious advertising.
But they still have to use advertising. For example, big tobacco fought regulation, mm-hmm. and also the science of smoking's risks, as was, that story was told in by Eric Conway and Naomi Oreskes in Merchants of Doubt. More recently, we've seen similar things in ads about the fact that global warming does not exist. Have merchants of attention been trying to influence regulation or science all along?
I mean, the history, I don't know where you start since the very, very beginning. I'll mention also a related phenomenon is that there was a period where, you know, attention merchants, I'm talking about CBS and NBC in the 1950s, allowed their news, you'll be maybe interested in this, allowed their news to be sponsored by tobacco labels. And so, for example, the news show, the main news show on NBC in the 50s was the Camel News Caravan, Camel Cigarettes. And somehow, mysteriously, in their news show never reported on the links between cancer and tobacco. Somehow that missed them. They had other rules, too. They weren't allowed to show pipes or cigars on the show. So there was a long history of attention merchants having an interest in using whatever power they can muster to influence public policy.
I'm speaking with Tim Wu, who is a law professor at Columbia University. His previous book was the bestseller, The Master Switch, and now we are discussing The Attention Merchants, the Epic Scramble to Get Inside Our Heads. It's published by Knopp. We will continue our conversation after a brief break. We're back with Tim Wu, who is a law professor at Columbia University. Also, he is the author of a number of books. The one we're discussing is The Attention Merchants, The Epic Scramble to Get Inside Our Heads. It is published by Knopf. You begin your book with a description of advertising making its way into public schools. What's happening there?
Yeah, well, this is really kind of a unfortunate story to my mind. There's been a huge problem with funding for a lot of public schools in poorer parts of the country, and one of the things they've turned to is advertising, and the idea is, of course, that you have young audiences who are captive. And
aren't children particularly susceptible to advertising?
Very, very impressionable. So, you know, the image of, you know, Ronald McDonald or Coca-Cola or whatever it is can stay in people's minds for a very long time. And that's the reason, by the way, advertisers usually like younger audiences, because you could have built a lifetime of brand association. And so, you know, whether it's the lockers being completely covered with banner ads, whether it's sponsored stadiums, sometimes they have teaching modules that have ideas. Advertising has come to a lot of public schools, and I think it's an unfortunate thing.
And kids nowadays have smartphones. They may use several devices at once. For example, they can watch television while they're networking on their phones. Are attention merchants encouraging that or trying to capitalize on it?
You know, I think the same logic of trying to reach younger audiences is everywhere, and I think it's not restricted to any particular medium of advertising. And smartphones are just a very good platform. I mean, it's obviously not children having platforms, but teenagers, a very helpful platform for getting at those audiences.
Content is often very brief. Snapchat videos can be no longer than 10 seconds. Tweets are limited to 140 characters, although pictures and videos now can be added to them. Is new technology whittling away at our attention spans?
I think one of the consequences of an advertising model that backs so many things is you need people constantly being distracted, looking at new things, you know, homo distractus, who's ready for something else. The businesses rely on advertising don't want you sitting down and reading a book for 3 hours. That's like stealing from them, or you know what I mean? In the sense, there's no ad exposure. So if you look at content, I mean, television was already kind of like that with sitcoms, and you know, every 10 minutes or something, there's an ad. But now we've gotten to the points where every 5 seconds or so, there's a new click, a new ad, a new payload. And so I think that the structure of economy is creating this kind of sensation people have, where they have short attention spans, feel very distracted. You know, it's not us. I mean, it is us, but it's not in the sense it's our faults. It's this kind of crazy environment we live in, which it's almost like a casino. I don't know if you've had this experience where you sit down to the internet. Maybe you're going to write an email, and then suddenly you notice 4 hours have gone by. You've clicked on, you know, 50 different things. You've been exposed to who knows how many different ads or subtle messages or tracking technologies. And that's kind of what's driving us crazy. And so I'm saying it's not just us and the way we use our technologies. It's that the technologies are programmed to make us receptive to advertising content.
It seems almost addictive. It's rare when I get into an elevator and all the other people in the elevator aren't looking at their smartphones. Many thought that the internet would have a democratizing influence, giving more control to people. How are things turning out?
Well, that's a complicated question. I don't think you can answer it up or down, democracy or not. On the one hand, there's been a huge proliferation number of voices that are heard. And, you know, there are bloggers who have been able to compete with major news outlets, and I think that's worth crediting. On the other hand, I think we've seen over the last 10 years a consolidation into a few really big platforms that was not predicted, who have much more control over your time and attention than anyone else. The attention economy has had a few big winners. And I think that is, you know, having, I don't think it's like quite a threat to democracy at this point, but it is certainly different than people thought at the beginning of the internet.
Who are the current leaders among the attention merchants?
I mean, in the world, or if you talk about the internet, it's very clearly the big attentional platforms: Google, Facebook, the most obvious among them, Twitter, sort of, and others behind them. And they have,
veritable. Not if Donald Trump has his say.
Yeah, that's true. He's gonna. He's someone who has been very successful in using these platforms to their fullest extent. I'll say that much.
The big three television networks are trying to catch up with HBO, Netflix, and Amazon. So that's changing as well.
No, I agree. It's from a business perspective, it is a very interesting time where they're all competing. They don't know what the rules are. And it is, as we said, very much competition for attention and competition for eyeballs. It's just unclear that what we're going to be left with at the end is something that we find attractive. And I'm particularly concerned, I mean, business is business, the media is usually a business, but I'm particularly concerned that everything being ad-driven models, that it'll all lead to the sort of the bottom, which is something that's happened to television before and something that's happened on the internet and web with clickbait. And obviously, I think that's a bad development.
In your previous book, The Master Switch, and now in The Attention Merchants, you wrote about Theodore Newton Vail and the new technology company he led, AT&T. How would they, how did they influence the market for our attention?
Well, AT&T plays a much lesser role in this book, but they must be they must get their credit for starting the first radio network. This is not really well known, but the first radio station that was connected to all the other radio stations and therefore would gather up huge, you know, millions of people at once and send them a single message.
That was WEAF.
My memory slightly fails me, but WEAF. That's exactly right.
And they supposedly ran the very first on-air ad.
That's true, which I believe was for a housing complex in Queens, if I'm not mistaken.
Now, why would AT&T want a radio station?
Well,
it's a telephone company. And telegraph.
For one thing, it's all communications. For another, they connected the radio station. So that the reason they were a network is they own the long lines, the wires that connected all the radio stations together. And they, I think, saw it as just part of their ever-increasing empire. I mean, at that point, they had already monopolized the telephone, so where was there to go next? And that was the radio. Their network eventually became NBC, so people don't always know this. But
RCA, which was owned by General Electric, acquired it. That became NBC in 1926.
That's right.
And did they have any competition at the beginning?
At the beginning, very little. I mean, there was still local radio. In fact, there still is local radio. eventually, though, CBS grew to be a competitor.
Well, you say we're local. It's interesting. WMYC is local. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I have listeners all over the world because of the Internet.
Right. Well, that's one of the many ways in which the world has changed. We're in this strange point of history where things can be intensely local, as you just pointed out, but then also intensely international or national at the same time. And I actually think things are going back towards that. There's not much room left in the middle, you know, either intensely local or completely international and national.
David Sarnoff was the guiding force behind NBC, and then William Paley led CBS. What strategies did they adopt for the companies?
You know, William Paley of CBS is one of the most fascinating figures in media history, kind of a type lost to our times. And he's a very interesting story because he understood better than anyone something that we all take for granted, which is that programming, the mixture of content, would be for the key for accumulating these massive audiences and reselling them to advertisers. NBC was weirdly, I won't say completely indifferent to content, but sort of careless in how they chose it. But CBS was the master in the early radio and then the early television of putting together prime time in just a certain way that would, and choosing the right people. You know, he understood Lucille Ball, who was a sort of B-rated actress, would be a hit with audiences. He put together the first game shows. They had the $64,000 question. You know, he understood the innate appeal of these things and how they could get millions of people. I mean, it's really extraordinary what CBS did and NBC. And if I can just finish on this, they managed to get, you know, 50 or 70 million people every night watching the same thing. Almost never happens now other than presidential debates and Super Bowls.
But even the presidential debates, it gets spread out over a number of different stations. Then you had pretty much two, and then later with ABC, three networks that dominated most of the viewership.
Right.
Cable came in, and then other stations, other networks were formed, and now it's really spread out.
It is spread out. I mean, it's amazing. If you get an audience of a million people, that's a pretty great accomplishment. So that era, the 50s, I think it's remarkable. The only entities that had succeeded in gaining those kind of audience previously were totalitarian regimes like the Nazi radio, which had the whole population listening. One reason why, if you didn't, you were punished. The Third Reich is also a fascinating actor in this because they had prime time. The only difference is you were listening to Hitler and you were forced to listen. But they did also have this, you know, 70 whatever millions of people listening.
We still have that in North Korea. Oh, yeah, they do. There's one radio station, and you have to keep it on.
Right.
Weren't the early ads on radio pretty dry, almost infomercials? When did they start becoming entertainment in their own right?
Well, that's an interesting story. The reason that they were dry, as you say, was because the idea of advertising on radio was thought of as completely outrageous in the early 1920s.
And people objected at the beginning?
People objected. Not only the people who ran radio objected. There was this scientific miracle. We're going to pollute it with advertisements for diapers and shoes. I mean, you must be kidding. Hoover, when I gave a big speech, he said, we cannot allow this miracle of radio be corrupted by advertising. And so the beginnings of radio advertising were sponsored programs. So Gillette, for example, sponsored a program on the history of the beard and said, sponsored by Gillette. And so sponsorship was the first way. And then the sponsorship got more elaborate. Pepsodent sponsored this show, Amos and Andy, which Amos and Andy was the first big primetime hit. And they, at the end of every show, they'd say, sponsored by Pepsodent toothpaste, go to your dentist and brush twice a day.
But that was it.
That was it. But then it got longer. So then they would say, sponsored by Pepsodent, did you know that Pepsodent uses an unbelievable whitening agent, which we have invented, which keeps your breath clean and also whitens your teeth and blah, blah. So they became longer and longer and longer. So it's more like a commercial. Most things in advertising happen that way. They start with this tiny kind of subtle thing that doesn't seem like much, and then it gets longer and longer and longer.
Although we had a very different model for broadcasting than other countries. In Europe, most of the countries had created national government-run broadcasters. We didn't actually wind up with public broadcasting until fairly late.
No, that's exactly right. Public broadcasting is, we are at a public radio station. Did not begin until the late 1960s. Well, there was earlier stations, but NPR, the invention of this, is in the late
There were college 60s. Stations and others.
College stations, early 60s. And, I think, just to say this, there is a difference. And this is kind of the main message of my book, is the economic model of the media changes the message. It seems obvious, but public radio, I mean, here you are listening to it, it is a lot different than commercial ad-supported radio. And, Wikipedia is a lot different than clickbait. And I think we really need to start thinking about what kind of media we want. That's part of why during the break I gave a donation, I'll have to admit. I've come to believe that we really need to support the media that we want to see, that what you pay for, you will end up seeing. Sorry, I'm going on a little bit here, but I've come to think that's very important.
But aren't we attention merchants as well in public broadcasting?
I think you are in a different model. I mean, you gather a large audience, but last time I've checked,
we definitely want attention.
Yeah, sure, but that's different. There's a difference between being an attention merchant and being merely attention seeking. And so I think there's a role for, public for broadcasting. I'm not saying that no one can speak to audiences. You just have to talk to your friends. But what you don't do, at least I don't think you do, is say, okay, look, I've got this many listeners, and I'm going to subtly put in a pitch for Ray-Ban sunglasses into this interview. I guess I just did that, but you know what I mean. Like there's not another set of transactions. You and I.
I think my boss has heard me slipping in secret little plugs for different commercial enterprises. I'd get in a lot of trouble.
No, and this is really right. This is a serious issue. Is you and I think. At least I'm trying to just speak to our, audiences, and we're not trying at some subtle way to, try to present selling opportunities for another set of corporate institutions who want us to somehow make them buy something. So that's a very different set of motives. And I think those motives can be quite corrupting over the long term, as my history suggests.
There are a host of fairly new areas of study, data analytics, big data, neuroscience, behavioral economics. How are they being used by the attention merchants?
So this is all within the last 10 years. The idea in advertising has been, this rise of ad tech and other technologies, is to try to get, basically much more scientific and isolate people much more carefully as to who exactly they are, when they're interested in buying, what kind of life events are going on. A company like Facebook is very sophisticated in this respect. they can tell by watching very carefully that either, you know, that someone's pregnant or expect, sometimes before the people themselves are pregnant or expecting it or moving or something. And knowing that people buy things around major life events has motivated an effort to try and target just the right message at just the right time.
Well, didn't Mark Zuckerman do a dual concentration in psychology and computer science before he dropped out of college and created Facebook?
He did, and I thought it was interesting. People would say, why are you wasting your time with psychology? And, you know, he's a geek. Other geeks would be, isn't that stuff a waste of time? And he said, it's not a waste of time.
With social networking and media, aren't we ourselves creating the stuff that's competing for our attention?
One of the kind of, you know, sometimes you look at stuff where people a generation ago would say, how did they let that happen? Somehow we've allowed our own content, you know, the stuff we create is pictures of toddlers, you know, news about family, to become hooks for advertising. And actually, the weird part is we don't get paid. I mean, I have a daughter, I have two daughters, but a daughter whose pictures are, you know, very cute and people like, obviously, all my friends like to see it. But for, putting those pictures on Facebook, I'm also providing content for advertisers to piggyback on. And sometimes I think, like, this is crazy. When did I agree to do this? And I guess it was the day I signed up for Facebook.
But meanwhile, you have written a book that you hope will get some attention here.
Well, that's the name of the game. I mean, you know, it's a very competitive market, and you have to accept it. You can either rail against it or say that to get things started in this day and age, it begins with attention.
Just one more thing before you leave. We associate you with the development of net neutrality theory. Mm-hmm. How's net neutrality doing these days?
Not bad. I think the administration's done a terrific job in passing a new net neutrality rule, and it survived attack in the courts. So, you know, at least for now, that danger, which is the danger of the big telecom companies taking over free expression, is at least temporarily in abeyance.
Tim Wu is a policy advocate and professor at Columbia Law School. His latest book is called The Attention Merchants, The Epic Scramble to Get Inside Our Heads. It's published by Knopf. Thank you for being on our show again.
Oh, it's great. I've loved it.
Mike Bartlett's new play, Love, 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 asks that most basic question, is it truly all you really need? It begins when Kenneth and Sandra meet and run off together during the summer of love in 1967, and then follows the course of their relationship as they become yuppies and negligent parents, betray, divorce, and reconcile. Love, Love, Love is at the Roundabouts Laura Pels Theater at 111 West 46th Street until December 18th, and I'm very pleased it has brought Richard Armitage and Amy Ryan, who play Kenneth and Sandra, and Zoe Kazan, who plays their daughter Rose, to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Whatever conflict we have across generations, can we agree that there was some wonderful music being played, being made during the 60s?
Oh, absolutely. That's what set it all off.
Yeah, are you all Beatles fans?
Yeah, I was actually into Fresh Cream and Eric Clapton, so there was a moment where we thought we might not get the rights to the Beatles song, so we presented another one, I Feel Free, we were working with. But it was great when we finally got the Beatles track, so yeah.
Well, I can't see why they would not want you to use it for this play.
They're the Beatles.
What's the time span of the play, Amy?
The play, when we first meet Kenneth and Sandra, it's 1967. And you'll follow these two characters for the next 40 years of their lives.
Is playing that range of years a challenge?
I gave myself permission when I started. I was like, well, I'm not going to fool anyone that I'm 19 years old, and hopefully I won't fool anyone that I'm 64. But I just think I just played with energy. I feel like, you know, I had a lot more energy when I was 19, so let me just go by that.
But are some ages more fun than others?
Oh, it's fun to. I was never a confident 19-year-old, so I am absolutely enjoying walking in Sandra's shoes through that time.
Zoe, do costumes help? Does putting on that school uniform bring you back to your high school days?
When I was in high school, I feel like it was like my braces took up so much of my imagination of myself that I couldn't really see past them. I think
your teeth look very good right
thank
now.
Thank you. My parents paid for it. I think that the costumes do a great job, and we have a really talented person who created those for us. But I also think a lot of it is in Mike's language. You know, I think it's sort of like a time machine; like it takes us all there. And the age is actually sort of the easiest part of it in some way.
Well, Richard, do you think that this play is particularly about the British experience? Did the United States and Britain differ fundamentally in what was happening culturally during the 60s?
It was definitely a question that I asked as I was prepping before I'd met these guys, before I'd met Michael Mayer, and I was looking at the play. I was thinking, well, how does this resonate to an American audience in terms of references?
Vietnam War was so important.
Exactly.
In
that was
country.
The main thing, I think, that was the main difference, was that kind of huge slice of action that was happening that really split a generation, probably the baby boomers, in half, I think. But it doesn't seem to have made much of a difference in terms of the play's reception. I think every reference that we were concerned about is being received and understood, and it's kind of remarkable.
Amy, for us, it was also an era of civil rights and class wars and fighting the draft, trying to look after the earth, as well as the era of free love.
Yes, I think...
Which ended in a speedway in San Francisco, according to many.
You know, I think Kenneth and Sandra, they glom onto these wonderful ideas of this, you know, free life, but probably it was just a gateway to sex and drugs. I don't know how much they really stood behind the political beliefs or part of the movement.
We see two generations coming of age in this play. It does seem like it's a lot more fun in the 60s than it does later for Zoe's character.
One thing that we did the first day of rehearsals, we had everyone in the room step into their generational group and discussed it. And one thing that the Gen Xers talked about, which is what my character Rose is a Gen Xer, they all talked about the fear of AIDS and the fear of sex being a huge difference between them and the boomer generation. Mm.
And there are also fewer economic opportunities for your characters than there were for the boomers.
Yeah, there are. I mean, I feel it even more. Like, I'm at the top end of millennial, and my sister is 3 years younger than me. And watching my peers and her group come out of college and not have any jobs available has been really horrible, actually.
So, Richard, is this a play about generational warfare?
I think it's about generational legacy, and I think it's something everyone's really got on their mind at the moment, especially during election cycles and major kind of voting opportunities that happen, particularly in Britain at the moment. It's, you know, the baby boom generation is, by, you know, definition, a large amount of people. So it has a huge voting power, and they tend to put people in power that are going to benefit their own themselves to an extent.
But to some degree, the themes of this play go all the way back to Greek tragedy. Parents and their children, and didn't Mike Bartlett address the generational warfare in his previous play to come to New York, King Charles III?
I didn't see that play.
Well, but if you remember, Queen Elizabeth dies and Charles ascends to the throne, but then his kids arrange for a coup.
Right.
What love. I mean, what astounds me by Mike Bartlett's talent is that when you look at or read any of his plays, it's hard to imagine it's written by the same writer. They feel so different. And
that was written in rhyme couplets. This
exactly,
one is not.
Yes, and he also has such a strong voice for every character. It's not just one character on the page. You feel his voice, and I think what love in terms of the family dynamic is how narcissistic and selfish the parents, they're living their life to their fullest, which could be admirable, but yet it really is, the children become collateral damage by their selfishness. And I suppose there is a theme of that maybe with,
Yeah, and I also feel like as you said, you talked about the fun of the 60s, and certainly I have a lot of fun in Act One, but it's a world where there were walls to be pushed down and laws to be repealed, and life was very limited, and I think that it took a great deal of energy to do that. But once those walls were down and the laws were repealed, as Zoe's character says in Act Three, you built the ladder and then broke it as you climbed, to an extent, and I think that's true.
What's Rose's...
What's the actual line?
...complaint in particular, Zoe?
I think her complaint in particular is that her parents that their generation didn't care for the generation underneath, that they didn't think about how their actions were affecting others. She has a whole tirade where she talks about what they did to the environment and how they voted in all of these policies and reduced taxes and destroyed the unions and did all of these things that benefited them in the short term but didn't think long term. And I think it's a valid complaint, not just about the boomer generation, but about the generations before. And I think if you see like the way that voting in this country is going, I think that we're really relying a lot on very young people to save us from our worst impulses.
We're speaking about Mike Bartlett's latest play to come to New York called Love, Love, Love. It's at the Roundabouts Laura Pell's Theater at 111 West 46th Street. And my guests are Zoe Kazan, Richard Armitage, and Amy Ryan. I was a student in London in the early 60s before the Beatles hit, and there was a feeling that it was a kind of a pre-Renaissance feeling. And then when I returned 10 years later, it felt as though the Renaissance had come and gone in about a day. And everything was Baroque. The idealism had turned into Carnaby Street commercialism.
That's probably true, actually. And it's interesting because when I gathered a kind of portfolio of images, because I was not alive in that period, and actually when you see it visually, it's the beginning of capitalist England. I mean, it's all about look and colour suddenly arriving in life and a generation being permitted to be teenagers and that becoming kind of a commodity. It's you can sell to those people. I think that was the beginning of the 80s, to be honest. It was the thread back to the 80s.
Is this your first play, your New York theatre debut?
It is, indeed.
Although you've done quite a bit in London?
A fair amount, not enough, not as much as I'd like. But yeah, it's the first time I get to set foot on the American stage.
Had you seen the play in London?
No, I haven't. I haven't.
Now, you're the only Brit in this cast. How are they doing with their British accents?
From day one, they were kind of perfect from day one. In fact, I was going home at night thinking, my accent's all over the place. I'm really in trouble here. But no, they were brilliant. Like, and when I hear them break into their American voices now, I'm shocked I don't recognize who they are.
We're seeing more... it's a lot better now. I don't know what's happened with accents, but British actors, Australian actors, they do perfect American accents now. No, do you're they? Saying no?
We're all giving you
like a strong R.
You know, sorry. We had Charlize Theron on this show. She's from South Africa. She speaks only with an American accent.
Yeah, hers is very good, I think. Yeah.
And you don't think American actors do good British accents these days? Because they used to be terrible. They just thought that if they said Bath, everything was okay.
I think the standards have come up with the criticism, the instant criticism of the internet age. I think nothing gets by. The people online.
But also I think there's so much more access. When I was younger and I would have to do an accent for something, let's say, like, if it was, I remember having to do a southern accent, I would call a hotel in Mississippi and just ask, tourist-related questions just to hear someone speak. But now, you go online, you can watch anything, any kind of news clip. You can find real people talking. And so I just feel like the tools are there.
In getting back to the play, did university also create rifts like the one between Kenneth and his brother? Is that because the brother wasn't smart enough to go to university?
Speaking for myself, it was definitely a kind of it became very available because of the grant system, and in my lifetime I saw that system disappear. I saw kind of vocational grants completely erased.
In the 60s, you reached a certain age in well, I can't say public school because public school meant private school in England. But anyway, and you would be separated. There were the college-bound kids, and then there were the kids who would be taught some kind of trade.
Yes, and it's happening as we speak that there is a debate in British Parliament at the moment about reintroducing grammar schools, which were the ticket to university, and secondary modern was basically a vocational school where women learnt typing and men learnt bricklaying, and it was separating.
Why do you think it's happening now?
I really can't tell you.
Can we blame this on Brexit? Is we going to blame everything else?
We probably can blame it on Brexit. It's just another way of making a kind of early definition of where these kids are going to go, and I think it's ridiculous to be
honest.
And
of class,
always with the Brits. It's always about class.
And it always has been, even though supposedly during the 60s, the class differences were broken down to some degree because now you had the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and others becoming a kind of a secondary royalty.
Yeah.
Well, that's one thing that I think we haven't really talked a lot about the play, but these characters come up class-wise over the course of the play, monetarily, but also they sort of supersede the class that they were born into, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, when you look at that room in Act One, we're starting in a kind of slightly elevated working class position, and we're ending up in definitely the lower middle classes, which is a big shift, you know, and that's what a university education grants you.
Is it also fair to say that the boomers struggled to throw off their parental control? Wasn't that the liberation of the 60s? Wasn't that what it was about? When Sandra advises Rose to do what she did to her mother and tell her to, well, let's say, get lost, because we can't say what she says on the air. Does she really mean it?
Oh, yeah. Sure. And the two arguments of the play of, you know, that Rose is stuck in this, her generation stuck in this economic, kind of obstacle.
Parents are more selfish.
The parents
boomers.
Are selfish, but I feel like there's two bits of advice or two. You know, I find myself saying, like, yes, buy her the house. But at the same time, I'm going, no, get up and make something of yourself. If you're not happy, change it, you know. And yes, of course, economically you need help there, but there are obstacles there. But in terms of Rose's argument of, you didn't tell me that I wasn't good at violin. Well, but you have to follow what makes you happy. So I find that by rebelling, whether you use colorful language in that rebellion with your parents, the way Sandra advises, is part of growing up.
I think it's harder in the sort of like high millennial, low Gen X generations, because those generations were told they were special so often.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of that's the underpinning of her complaint in some way.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's true.
Are the reactions of the audience to the play different depending on audience ages? When one of my producers saw it, the matinee ladies all rolled their eyes as Rose was confronting her parents.
Don't listen. You could feel it. You could feel the different audiences.
You can
for
hear
sure.
it. Too.
You can hear it. Yes. Yeah. There's usually rounds of applause and
groans and tutting.
Yeah. For sure.
Now, we mentioned costumes, and actors often talk about how important a costume actually is for getting into a role. But each time the curtain rises on a new act, we know exactly where we are in time and have a good idea of what happened to the characters in the interim. Richard, as a Brit, tell us, what is the joke about the particular suburb that they're in during the second act?
It was something that came up in the rehearsal room. You know, how do we define what Reading is to an American audience? How do we somehow indicate that? And we couldn't find a kind of relative.
Yeah.
Is it kind of like Larchmont or Cedarhurst?
No, I don't think it's that. But it would be. It's probably something closer to an airport than the hub of a vibrant city.
It's sort of the epitome of the mundane. It's a perfectly square, very nice-sized box that they've found themselves in. There's nothing wrong with Reading. It's nicely manicured, but it's just nice. That's it. and it's slightly
deadening. And what would that indicate about how their with the direction their lives had gone in?
I think the kind of energy with which they leave Act One, you know, literally falling into their future, this idea of going on an adventure and traveling the world, and he's going to be a travel writer, that they somehow have in that gap between Act One and Act Two, however, 16 years, 17 years, that they've had to make compromises in their life. They've put themselves into a box that they didn't want to be in, and they start therefore living vicariously through their children, pushing her out the door to be an artist.
Do you see this show as a comedy? The second act is so painful, but the audience is roaring with laughter.
I see it as a dark comedy. I mean, we certainly are enjoying ourselves, and but we actually see it as almost there's three scenes and three acts, almost like three separate plays, and that's represented by the sets that change so drastically. I guess both Mikes have given us permission to fall into the different tones of each play, each act.
Now, Richard, you're also opening on television now in Berlin Station.
Yes, Sunday night we had our first premiere, our first outing, yeah.
And that's on Epix?
Epix, yeah.
Epix, it's pronounced? Yeah. I've always wondered. Can you tell us a bit about that series?
Yeah, it's a modern-day spy drama. It's loosely based on the idea of a whistleblower like Edward Snowden called Thomas Shaw, and my character, Daniel Miller, is sent to Berlin to track him down. And it feels very relevant that the subject matter that we're talking about is this lifting of the lid of secrets on the CIA, which is potentially going to fracture the entire institution. So it was fascinating.
And Zoe, what's The Deuce, which is coming up on HBO?
Yeah, I just have a small part on it. It's David Simon's new show. It's about the porn industry in New York in the 70s and 80s. And I played James Franco's wife, who's like a sort of mob princess.
You wrote
typecasting.
You wrote and starred in the film Ruby Sparks. Are you writing anything now?
Yeah, actually, my boyfriend and I adapted Richard Ford's novella Wildlife together, and he is about to start directing it in 2 weeks. He's in pre-production right now.
Amy, do most people recognize you from The Office?
Some. I feel like it's split into two worlds between The Wire and The Office, from a TV thing.
Yeah. Well, it's not bad to have been in two huge hits. What is Abundant Acreage available? When will we be able to see that?
Hopefully sometime next year. That's a film by Angus McLaughlin, who wrote Junebug, and it's his latest film that he's also directed.
And this play, this production, Love, 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 is it an open run?
December 18th is our, we're selling tickets through now.
And it's at the Roundabouts Laura Pels Theater at 111 West 46th Street. And my great thanks to its cast members, Richard Armitage, Amy Ryan, and Zoe Kazan for being on our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.